Hey, the start of something special right here, man. Let's go.
Number one fantasy player right here.
Got past the line. Shut up. Know the rules.
I just want to say this to you. Right now, best in the game. I know.
Hello, and welcome in to the Pod After Touchdown Fantasy Football Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Hoppin, joined as always by my co-host, Andrew Mackins. We are without our producer tonight, but Andrew, how are you doing this week?
I am swell. Today, we're recording a little bit earlier, which is why we don't have our producer. The reason we're doing that is because I'm celebrating my 4 years of dating my lovely girlfriend, and I'm, you know, so lucky to have her. So that's a great thing to talk about, some positivity to kick off the show. We're going to bang out this podcast, and then I'm going to go hang out with my girlfriend.
That's not the way I thought you were going to take this. But, we'll go from there. But congrats to you two. 4 years is...
I honestly can't believe it.
It's kind of crazy. I know when it came up for Christina and I, it felt like it had been a year. It's the old adage of time flies when you're having a good time. So
yeah,
congrats to you and Heather. Hope you both have a great time tonight and this week, quote unquote, hanging out. but we're going to get into some fantasy football stuff. Obviously, we've got some trade deadlines coming up. So we'll kick things off with a question around that. We'll do our mental health minute. Talk about our DiGiorno players of the week, do our meat of the show, which is going to be talking about process and trusting the process. What are some general decision-making tips we can give to fantasy managers out there, especially as we enter that time of the season where those become ever more critical, and then we'll get into our start sits for this week. But without further ado, let's kick things off.
And this game is underway.
So last week, we talked about some league winners that we had our eye on. But who after week nine are some additional trade targets you would or should think about acquiring about in order to improve your roster?
I heard a couple good ones from our friend of the podcast, JJ Zacharyson. He mentioned like Derrick Henry might be an opportunity to buy now. I think Ronald Jones is interesting since he still seems like he's the starter. But the guy that I want to focus on that I really looked at going into this episode was Allen Robinson. And I think Allen Robinson's an attractive piece because he's a great player. There's no question about that. And his playoff schedule is pretty crazy. I got to look it up. But as I'm looking it up, you know, when you're talking to the person about trading for Allen Robinson, you just hammer home the fact that they're playing a backup quarterback as their starter, and their backup, you know, could be the starter, but then you're just saying it's two backup quarterbacks on the team, basically, Trubisky and Foles. They haven't really figured it out. I mean, Foles did throw for, 350 yards last week, which is crazy, but I digress. The final three games for the fantasy playoffs for the Bears are the Vikings, the Texans, and the Jaguars. Not in that order. It's Texans, Vikings, Jaguars for weeks 14 through 16. So that's a really juicy schedule in my book, and I think Allen Robinson is still going to continue to get work, particularly in PPR. I love him as a trade target.
Right. You don't even mention the rest of their schedule. Obviously, they have a bye in week 11, so you won't be able to play them then. But they play Minnesota this week on Monday Night Football. They play the Lions in week 13, and they play the Packers, who, you know, have shown that they can let a couple things slip through on their defense. I think there was the report today that they're thinking about adding an eighth playoff team, and that I think owners had approved that proposal depending on whether the, you know, entire season gets played out. And this definitely helps Allen Robinson or players like Allen Robinson, because the Bears are in the mix for the playoff hunt right now. So if there's a little bit higher chance that they make the playoffs, it's not, you know, not that they're going to shut down Allen Robinson by any means, but if they're out of the playoff hunt a little bit earlier, maybe they try to get more opportunities to some of their younger players to try and evaluate them. So I think Allen Robinson's a great pick for sure.
The bye week is a huge thing too, because you can play factor that into your trade talks. Like, hey, right, I'll take this guy off your hands. Well, he's got the bye next week. You need a player who does not have a bye, so let me send you someone who is not as good as Allen Robinson, but is done with their bye week. It's, you know, there's a lot of ways that I think you can pull Robinson from someone's hands.
And this is one of those scenarios too, where I think you can do a potential receiver for receiver trade. I usually don't like doing like same position trades unless it's a 2-for-1, just because there's really not much that you're adding to the other person's team unless that, you know, you just both like players on the opposite team. But this is an opportunity, like you said, if you're in a position where you basically have a playoff spot locked up and can afford to sit a receiver on a bye, you know, maybe you trade someone like, I mean, I really like Will Fuller, so I wouldn't give him up, but someone of that caliber who is past his bye and can offer the same type of ceiling that Robinson has shown in the past.
We talked about this last week. We kept using his name, so I'll ask quickly, Michael Thomas or Allen Robinson, now that he's officially back?
So if we're taking out the fact that they're past their bye, because the extra game does make a difference, I'm going to go with Thomas, but it's very, very close. I'm still a little bearish on Michael Thomas. Obviously, he didn't have a great game this past week, but the Saints just obliterated the Texans. So in a more competitive game, maybe we saw, you know, maybe we see him get a little bit more involved, but the Saints schedule isn't terrible either. They play the Eagles, Chiefs, and Vikings in the fantasy football playoffs and get Atlanta twice in the next 4 weeks. So certainly some opportunities for some boom weeks.
Yeah, I tried to offer Thomas to someone from McLaurin, like we talked about, and they counteroffered with Michael Thomas for Michael Gallup, and I was just like, LOL, fuck you. I couldn't believe it.
That is quite the counteroffer.
It was quite an insulting counteroffer, but they must have been insulted by me. Anyway, you got a potential trade target yourself, Sam?
So I've got a group of guys, and it's basically all of the running backs that are coming off of injury. So that includes Nick Chubb, Miles Sanders, Joe Mixon, and Chris Carson. Now, a lot of this depends on, again, your standing in a fantasy football league, again, whether you think you have a good shot at the playoffs and you can stomach potentially these guys missing another week or two. But it sounds like they're all, most of them are on track to be playing in week 10. And before they were injured, we're getting the type of workload that we were hoping they would get. And, you know, someone earlier today asked me what I thought a reasonable running back target would be if he was trading away Michael Thomas, and I told him that this was a good group of guys to target if you think you can sell Thomas off of the sort of potential that he's going to return to his greatness after we saw him, you know, play a decent role in that game. So I don't really have a strong lean over one of these guys over the others, but I do think they offer some potential buy low value while they're coming off the injuries, especially if there's a manager that is really in a tight spot and can't wait to see if the players are active or not.
I like that. I like that a lot. You got to try to find that value at running back where you can.
Okay, so let's get into our mental health minute, which I think, Andrew, you're going to take us through today.
Yeah, I you do a lot of these, Sam, and I appreciate that. I think you put a lot of good research into it, and this is one that is always just in the back of my mind. I did, you know, the bare minimum in terms of research, but this is simply just a reminder to drink water. I know it's such an easy thing to say, and I've probably said this before when we talk about how to handle different scenarios, whether it be like being stuck inside with COVID and whatnot, but dehydration can truly have effects on your mental health. I found an article that we can share out on our Twitter at PodAfterTD. It says that human brain is about 75% water. So if you think about, I don't know, I suppose it's basic science that says dehydration slows your circulation, and that can result in less oxygen traveling to your entire body, including your brain. Scientists suggest that this thirst impulse we get is part of the body's complex warning system, and it should not be ignored, even if you just feel a little parched. And so my reminder for you all is, you know, if you have a headache or if your mood is off, it might just be because you haven't had much water in a while. It's definitely easy to forget drinking water. I will start my mornings a lot with like a cup of coffee, and then you're already at like a, in my mind, an H2O deficit. So remember what Bobby Boucher says and drink that H2O.
Got to get the high quality H2O. yeah, this is great. I mean, I drink a ton of water throughout the day, where it makes my restroom breaks a little bit more frequent than I'd like. But it's something easy to forget, that's for sure.
I used to never drink coffee, and when we lived together, Sam, we always were drinking from these stadium cups of water. And I haven't used one in so long, but now that I've got it again, it's like very easy to chug like 12 ounces and still have your cup full of water. So that's very helpful.
Good stuff. Well, thanks for walking us through that. Before we get into our DiGiorno players of the week, I had a listener, a very special listener in my father, George Hoppin, reach out to me and ask if DiGiorno was in fact a sponsor of the podcast. And unfortunately not. The way this segment got brought to light was we wanted a chance to just bash some players that did absolutely terrible in a given week. And if you follow advertising, DiGiorno's slogan is, it's not delivery, it's DiGiorno. So we get a chance here to talk about some guys who do not deliver and are DiGiorno-esque players on the week. So with that, Garner, hit the music.
All right, Sam, I'm going to go first. And you know what rhymes with DiGiorno? It's DJ Moore No. DJ Moore was a big fat no in your lineup this week. I thought it was going to be a shootout against the Chiefs, but you know what? It was. There was a lot of opportunity for the Panthers, but DJ Moore only ended up with 2 targets, 2 receptions, 18 yards, 0 touchdowns. This DJ Moore season has crushed my soul. I hate it so much. I don't know whether to blame Joe Brady or Matt Rhule or Curtis Samuel or Robbie Anderson or whoever, but it just fucking sucks. It sucks. It sucks. It sucks. It sucks.
DJ Moreno was certainly a way to kick this off, but I'm going to go with DeAndre Hopkins, who just went straight into the gutter this week in a game similar to DJ Moore, in which the team scored 31 points. He had 3 catches for 30 yards, which is just atrocious. I mean, this guy's been on a tear all week. You rely on him for consistent production week in and week out, and he just did not deliver whatsoever.
The wide receivers, they giveth and they taketh away. It happens. You know, it happens. We just gotta vent about it sometimes, so here we are for you.
Venting certainly is helpful and is something I always look forward to in this part of our show.
Shout out to all the PS2 gamers who know the Spider-Man 2 pizza delivery missions where that music comes from.
Yes, indeed. That was a good time 10 years ago. Probably 15 years ago.
Probably, actually. Honestly, quick sidebar, probably one of the best PS2 games ever.
Yeah.
Like, I know we're multiple definitely. Generations away from that. Xbox Series X is coming out now. Oh, PS5. God. We're like 3 consoles from then, but PS2, still good days.
Yeah, I did just see a an advertisement for, I think, a Miles Morales Spider-Man video game, which sort of brought me back to those days. But I digress. Let's get into the meat of our show, which we're going to call Trust the Process. We're going to talk about trusting our process and not getting scared off by the results, talking about some general decision-making tips, because this is a weekly game. I mean, we have the draft at the beginning of the season, and that builds a foundation for your team, but there are decisions that we have to make each week to win and win our league. So, Andrew, I believe you were going to kick us off for this segment today.
Of course, and a lot of this really came from me just wanting to pry open the mind of a Sam Hoppen, because I know you're in actually fewer leagues this year than last year. I took on more for some reason, and I've been doing more playing and tweeting, but it's really, I think, spread me thin in terms of the decision making that I'm doing on a weekly basis. And I know you're doing a lot, like diving into the numbers, and I think it's just curious for interesting for our listeners to understand the mind of an analyst. And so we've got a few different case studies here, or different ideas that we're going to dive deep into, and hopefully we can apply them to our listeners, our audience, general process.
Really kicking it back to those business school days, talking about some case studies.
Oh yeah, these aren't Harvard Business Review case studies by any stretch, but
I'd imagine these are more difficult to figure out.
they might be, even though they're nowhere near 10 pages. All right, so case one: how do you identify bad processes, in hindsight, so you can correct it? And this comes from, when you start one player over another, and the guy you had on your bench scored more fantasy points. Hindsight's 20/20, so you're like, oh, I shoulda, coulda, woulda started the guy on my bench. But maybe that's not necessarily true unless you identify that the process you went through was actually bad and you should have made the other decision and you just didn't think it through right. So, and we always say, like, this comes from that phrase, process over results. So the individual instance that I'm going to use to kick this off is, I started DJ Moore, like I said, over Juju Smith-Schuster in week 9. Juju had the better matchup against the Cowboys. He had more targets over the past 2 weeks compared to DJ Moore. I think the worry for many individuals asking about Steelers going into week 9 was that the positive game script against a very bad Cowboys team, plus having all the receivers that the Steelers have now being healthy, like Deontay Johnson, Chase Claypool, James Washington, having all those guys healthy would mean maybe not enough opportunity for Juju to actually, see success in this game. I thought DJ Moore would be in a negative game script against the Chiefs. However, I don't think I really factored the fact that CMC was coming back to the game and he got 10 targets, 10 receptions. So, and then the other thing I saw, I had more in my lineup. I had Juju on my bench last minute. I was like, nope, I'm not going to tinker this in. I'm going to stand with what my lineup is, because I don't want to tinker out of something into a bad decision. I think the main thing there for me is, like, tinkering doesn't affect how the players are going to perform. So you just have to make sure that you have considered everything in your process when you make the decision, and not the fact that, like, oh, who's in the lineup now versus who's on the bench right now, and whether I do the tinker or not last minute.
So let's stop there. Because
yeah,
because
I know that's a lot. It's a lot.
You made a couple of points. And, I think, your main question was, how do you identify bad process so you can correct it? And I think one trap that some fantasy managers fall into is saying things like, oh, if I had started Travis Homer over James Conner, then I would have won this week. But 100 times out of 100 times, you're starting James Conner over Travis Homer this week because of the aforementioned positive game script, because he's the bell cow back, and you can't predict that that James Conner is only going to get 3 points. And to your point, you had some legit reasons to be starting DJ Moore over Juju Smith-Schuster. So I don't think you should be necessarily beating yourself up for it. I mean, I think there are a couple takeaways from this, and most notably is something that's happened over the past 2 weeks is, you know, you pointed out that based on how big of a favorite the Steelers are, that they'll be in a positive game script and they'll just totally dominate, and then the running back is going to get all the touches. And I think that's a trap that people have fallen into with them and the Chiefs last week when they were playing the Jets, because they were such an overwhelmingly big favorite that everyone was like, well, you know, why would you play the Chiefs pass catchers, because CEH and Le'Veon Bell are just going to get all the touches when they're up by so much. But you also have to think they need to get to that implied team total somehow. And they can do that by passing. They can do that in the first half when the game is still relatively close and competitive and they still have their whole playbook open. And I mean, you saw even the Chiefs kept passing it in the second half and were scoring a boatload of points, and CEH and Le'Veon Bell did absolutely nothing. So there's a reason that those teams are so heavily favored. It's because they are good and they can score basically any way they want to against the defense. Now, this past week, it worked out in a way in which the Steelers were trailing for most of the game, so they had to throw the ball a little bit more. And I don't think your process of, again, picking DJ Moore over Juju was bad, but, you know, another question you have in here is, are we good at projecting game script, and should that be factored into our decision-making? I think we might not be good, but I think Vegas is very good at it. I mean, you look at the lines that they set in there, they're pretty darn accurate at a macro level, but I think the way people think about it is not the right way, to my points earlier about the Chiefs and the Steelers.
Yeah, so my follow-up to that would be, if Vegas is good at predicting it, I mean, they're good at predicting how much a team will win by and that it's going to be close and the odds of them winning a game. But to factor in, like, the play-calling aspect of that, like, the Chiefs still crush the Jets. But I think for a fantasy purposes, it's easy to say, like you were saying, like that they are going to run all over them once they're ahead. But does that almost factor into, like, what you mentioned a lot, the fallacy of logical coaching, almost in a way where we can't really predict what coaches are going to do. So, like, whether it's like, you know, what we want them to do versus what they actually do, or what we think that they're going to do, like, we're not calling the plays. The coaches are calling the plays. So the Chiefs, for in the example of the Jets, like, if Vegas had a very good idea that they were going to win by a lot, but how are they going to do that is a totally different story. And in this case, it was, or like 2 weeks ago, it was the case of Patrick Mahomes throwing all over them.
So I think there are rarely times in which coaches take their foot off the pedal when they are ahead. And I think that's, again, something that people take too much stock into, is that when a team is up by three or more scores in the third quarter, that team is only going to run. And I think that's just been a mindset for so long. But, you know, the first glimpse of that we really saw was the Patriots back in 2007, when they were just obliterating teams left and right. They would never let their foot off the gas. Bill Belichick was basically running up the score on other teams. And it's not that other teams are, quote unquote, running up the score, but we've seen a number of times teams give up massive, massive leads in the late fourth quarter. And it's never bad to have more points, right? I mean, it's never bad to do that. And, you know, you know, a good chunk of the touchdowns that the Chiefs had, I'm going to keep going back to this example, those were big chunk plays. I mean, they were deep shots downfield, and it's different than them going 12 plays to score a 5-yard passing touchdown. That's a little bit different because that's intended for them to sort of drain the clock out a little bit. But I don't know. It's tough to answer that. I mean, one way you could look at things is looking at some like neutral script pass to rush ratios for teams to get an understanding of, you know, when they are ahead, what are their tendencies, and looking at specific teams. I mean, if you're making a decision between DJ Moore and Juju Smith-Schuster, you know, looking at those play calling tendencies for those two specific coaches, if you see that the Steelers, when they're up by 14 or more points or whatever, then they're really only running the ball, then I think you have a legit reason to start DJ Moore over him. But if they are still passing it, or, you know, if the Panthers are like the Titans, for example, who will run the ball until they absolutely have to pass the ball,
yeah,
then I think, you know, then it could be swayed the other way.
Yeah, so the big takeaway I'm taking from this is for us trying to project the play calling on a game-by-game basis is maybe not the best way to do the decision-making. Again, the matchup was there for Juju. I kind of like looking back at it and thinking, I mean, obviously, hindsight is 20/20, so it's hard to say. Like Sam was saying, he gave me some credit as like, well, part of your DJ Moore process was right. But with Juju having the better matchup and having the better volume, those are some reasons that I like to look at for, you know, making a decision on one player over another. And less so, I think for me, I'm going to ignore game script a little bit less, especially because you don't know what's going to happen. Like, look at Saints Bucks, like that game completely. That's a whole nother case study we could dive into about how things went differently than maybe people expected. So let's get into the second case here. And basically a idea around upside versus floor when you're deciding between two players in your lineup. That an actual question that I was asked last week is, in a full PPR league, do you think I should start Brandon Cooks over Damian Harris at flex? I said in PPR, I'd go Cooks because, you know, Harris, you might not even catch a single ball. Obviously, Harris might have the higher floor because he's been getting a ton of carries, but Brandon Cooks has the higher ceiling. And that's obviously because he sees a lot of targets and he sees a lot of deep targets. He can always go off for a big play. So depending on what you need in your matchup, you know, if you need the floor, you'd probably go with Harris. If you want the ceiling, you go with Cooks. I think we have a good idea of certain players' range of outcomes because a guy like Brandon Cooks can be deemed as a boom-bust player. And his career's had different stretches, but that's a different conversation about him. I think starting someone for upside is definitely a thing. Like, if you're throwing Mecole Hardman into your lineup, you're doing it for the upside. But if that player doesn't hit, the takeaway here is you can't be angry with starting someone for upside and then him not hitting, because that's when like you're going to start to tilt. But my question for Sam, being the numbers guy, and I think the guy who's in the weeds on this, should we ever base our need for upside on the team we're facing? Or is it just a matter of looking at projections and then figuring it out from there?
So as far as the projections go, I mean, I think something that people don't necessarily understand with projections is that those projections are their median projections, right? So that's what's going to happen, you know, the majority of the cases. Every player has his 99th percentile outcome and his 1 percentile outcome as well. It's just more likely that certain players hit those tails of the projections than others. So like you were saying, with Cooks, there's a better chance that he hits his 90th percentile projection than Damian Harris does because of game script, because of opportunity, because of the team around him, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we should be basing our decisions on need for upside, because projections can give you a lens into whether you're an underdog or not. I mean, I think it's really only at the extremes. Like, I'm gonna make up some numbers here, but if your team is projected to have 60 points and the other team is projected to have 100 points, then there's a pretty good shot that your team is not going to win if every single player has their media, you know, hits their medium projections. But if you think about it in a way that, you know, what happens if all of your players hit their 90th percentile outcome and all of their players hit just their median projection, then do you have a chance, a better chance of winning? Because you're already sort of in the hole. And I think, you know, I don't know how many of our listeners play DFS regularly, but I think it's a matter of thinking about things in a tournament versus a sort of head-to-head or cash perspective. So in head-to-head or cash style games, you're really, you know, I mean, you're trying to find a ceiling as well, but you're a little bit more concerned about floor too, because you basically just need to finish in the top 50% of lineups in order to make some money. Whereas with tournaments, you need to hit the nuts and you need to get everything right to get some sort of money back. So in tournaments, you're looking for a lot more upside and looking for the guys that can reach their 90th percentile. I mean, I'm never starting Adrian Peterson in tournaments because he's never going to get me 25 points in a game of his career. And watch him go for 30 points against the football team this week. But the short answer is yes. And I get those questions a lot, and I frame it in the way that you do too, is I say, you know, if you need a ceiling or you need a guy with more upside, then go with this player. But if you're just looking for a decent floor, then I'd go with this guy. So I certainly think that's the right way to think about things.
Yeah, it's crazy because you look back at this last week, and I don't remember Harris's numbers from last night, but Brandon Cooks definitely hit, you know, at least his projection, if not more, on only three receptions because he had one big play and that got you the upside you were looking for. He did have nine targets, though, and I'm going to get to that in a second. The last question I had on this one, Sam, is do you know if there are any resources or like case, not to use the term case studies again, but has anyone in the fantasy community done something where they say, you know, within this certain range, this is how much upside you need in terms of like your projection? Because I know you're just spitting out numbers, but you used like a 40 point spread. And a lot of times I think, you know, teams that are only a player or two players difference might only be 10, 15 points apart in projections. And I wonder if there's been any research done on that yet, on what that spread might look like and how you would know, like, okay, well, if I'm within 10 points, I just play the guys I'd normally play. If I'm within 20 points, 15 points, 17 points, whatever it is. I mean, maybe we're splitting hairs there, but that's when I play the upside.
I don't think there is. I mean, that'd be exceptionally tough to look at because so many, I mean, you could do it on a sort of standard league basis. If you look at a league with two running backs, two receivers, a tight end, flex quarterback, you know, just some sort of standard roster settings and scoring settings, but those projections change every time you change this number of starters, the scoring, the type of scoring, all that sort of stuff. So I think it, you know, it would be interesting to see that, but I can't even think of a way to even start to approach that. So let's get to our last case here. And it's talking about opportunity versus talent.
Yeah, and that's why I bring up Brandon Cooks, because he did only have three receptions last week, but he had nine targets. I believe that's the fourth straight week that he's had nine targets. And I saw that tweet from a friend of yours, Adam Levitan, or Levitan. Did I pronounce that correctly? Levitan. So I don't want to tilt you, Sam, but let's just kick this off by talking about how many players you would start over David Montgomery at this point. Because you look at a player like Brandon Cooks, who had nine opportunities last week, and you compare that to David Montgomery, who had 17. Then you got to break that down. I'm sure in your head, I know you've looked at opportunities a lot of different ways. It's, you know, a 14 carries and three targets for Montgomery versus nine targets for Cooks. Obviously, the depth of those targets mean that, like, if it's a deeper target, it's more valuable. I don't know if you've done any research or have read anything on are certain targets more valuable than carries, or how much more valuable are they? I know, I believe it's Josh Hermsmeyer put together a weighted opportunity metric that's probably the best metric to use for weighting opportunity for different players. But is there any way we can simplify this for our listeners?
So it differs by position, right? So I think what Ben Gretsch does with his high value touches is, for me, the biggest thing that I look at for running backs in terms of opportunities, because I mean, you hear it in the name, high value touches. As far as wide receivers and tight ends, that's where I go to look at Whopper, which is weighted opportunity rating, which combines a player's target share on his team with his air yards share. So is he not only getting a lot of targets, but are they going, you know, relatively deep downfield as well? Because you don't want, you know, a 30 yard average depth of target, but you don't want it to be 1 yard either. So anyway, to answer your question, I would start about 1,000 people over David Montgomery. but it's tough to do it across positions, but I've just seen even David Montgomery, and this is a specific case here, but I've seen David Montgomery get 15 plus touches for several weeks in a row against some of the worst, quote unquote, worst defenses, and him just not do anything with it. And I'm not, you know, I'm going to need to see 2 or 3 weeks of decent production from him before I would even feel confident starting him. Because yes, he is getting a ton of opportunities. And I think next offseason, if his situation stays the same where he's the quote unquote primary back, I mean, Tariq Cohen will probably be back, but people will think he's a quote unquote buy low or a sleeper in drafts, and I'm just not going to touch him. So I overall, targets are more valuable than carries, especially for running backs. I mean, it depends on the type of league you're in too, right? I mean, a target in a PPR league is worth much more than a target is worth in a standard scoring league. But it's tough to compare these across positions. I will say that, again, we're talking about ceiling versus floor. I'd rather take Cooks with 9 targets because I feel like he has a better opportunity to do something with them than David Montgomery with 25 total opportunities, no matter how you...
All right. Well, we'll have to let our listeners figure out the math on that, 9 versus 25 opportunities. But to wrap up these, you know, David Montgomery versus the comps that I put in here, my assumption is whether it's David Montgomery versus Robert Woods, Mike Evans, DJ Moore, Justin Jefferson, Christian Kirk, I'm going to have to guess. You already said you'd start 1,000 players over David Montgomery. You'd probably take any of those 5 wide receivers, partially because of the upside that we talked about before, that they could, any of those guys could take a deep touchdown to the, like, take a deep catch to the house.
Yeah. The only guy that I would have some slight hesitation, I mean, you can nitpick any of these guys, and I wouldn't fault anyone for starting them over David Montgomery. I mean, Christian Kirk's shown the past couple of weeks that he's starting to turn those deep targets into production. Mike Evans is the one guy I was going to mention, though, because he hasn't played that well in the games in which Chris Godwin's healthy and Antonio Brown is there now. So his floor is among the lowest of any receivers. So but that said, I think his ceiling is much higher than what David Montgomery's is.
Right. Well, and I think this is an interesting spot to note. Mike Evans is a much better player than David Montgomery. Oh, yeah. Regardless of the situation happening in Tampa right now, I think it's oddly very murky, whether you want to blame that on Antonio Brown or not. But Mike Evans is a much better player. You can argue whether Christian Kirk is a quote-unquote better player than David Montgomery, but he seems to be performing better and doing more for his team than David Montgomery is doing. So maybe that's a way to think about it as well. A different conversation, since we were talking cross-position there, but let's talk one example for same position here. And it's another case study that's within my lineup So obviously very self-serving for me, but DJ Moore, again, who is crushing my soul, versus Jarvis Landry. And I'm looking at it for this week, but you know, I'm also thinking about it rest of season and how I should be thinking about these players. I think, obviously, because DJ Moore was a my guy for me, that DJ Moore is a more talented receiver. But we've seen throughout the season he's being used very differently. I still think Jarvis is an underrated receiver, and he's kind of been, you know, stuck on a weird offense with the Browns. But now that OBJ's out and the matchup this week is pretty good, like, there's a lot more potential for opportunity for Jarvis as well. And he could turn that into like a lot of production that we've seen from him in previous seasons. So I lean Jarvis based on the kind of recent metrics and just everything that's been happening with DJ Moore and Carolina. I need to stop talking about it. But for you, Sam, DJ Moore or Jarvis Landry?
For me, it's Jarvis Landry. And we talk about, you know, a lot of fantasy football is around talent versus opportunity. And I think where this needs to be talked about the most is in the offseason when we're drafting and not on a week-to-week basis. Because at this point in the season, we have 9 weeks of data, 9 weeks of usage to know generally how these guys are being used in an offense. And I don't expect DJ's Moore's, you know, even though I think he's more talented than Jarvis Landry, I don't expect that to, I guess, show itself in this 1 week sample that we have right now where I'm choosing between these two guys. I mean, we talked, you know, going back to this offseason, a lot of people thought Jonathan Taylor was such a great pick because of his talent. And, you know, they expected that his talent would eventually win out and sort of push Marlon Mack out of the starting job. Now, right away, that turned into opportunity for him because Marlon Mack got hurt. But we've seen over the past several weeks that the Colts are not willing to use Jonathan Taylor in a workhorse type role like Josh Jacobs or Derrick Henry or any of these guys. So you can't bet on talent at this point. I mean, I'd rather start I'm trying to think of an example here, but
a ham sandwich.
Not a ham sandwich. I'd rather start Todd Gurley over Jonathan Taylor. I think Jonathan Taylor right now is the better running back, but Todd Gurley's getting more opportunities. He's getting into the end zone, and as unsexy of a player as he is, he's getting all of that opportunity. And I just think in season, in a specific week, you shouldn't just say, well, J.K. Dobbins is getting three attempts per game, but this week his talent is really just going to blow him up. And
I am beating J.K. Dobbins into the ground of my lineups because of that talent, man. The opportunity is, oh my gosh, that is another good one as well.
And there's a little bit of this too, where J.K. Dobbins has been very efficient with the touches that he's gotten and Jonathan Taylor hasn't. So the thought is if he gets more opportunity, then he'll continue that efficiency. But I think with your specific case, I mean, I'd go with Landry because he's getting that opportunity and isn't competing with as many big name guys as DJ Moore. But
thank you. My lineup is set. My lineup is set for week 10. Thank you. I think we learned a lot this week. Did I cut you off? Did you want to say anything else about these?
No, I hopefully this helps some people better understand at least some of our decision making or help make decisions themselves this week. But we're going to put what we've learned into context here, help make some potential decisions, and let you know where we're standing on a couple of guys. So our first start sit here is a fun one. It's DJ Moore versus the Tampa Bay Buccaneers or Juju Smith-Schuster versus the Cincinnati Bengals. I'm going to let you start with this because I don't want you to get any sort of group thing.
I've made this very apparent throughout the podcast. DJ Moore's hitting the bench in the league of record, and Juju Smith-Schuster is sticking in the lineup. He's got a pretty good match against Cincy's defense, and I like that the opportunity has been there for the last 3 weeks now. So I'm rolling with Juju over DJ Moore.
I'm in the same boat as well. Our next one is Jacoby Myers versus the Baltimore Ravens. He had a great night this past Monday Night Football on his birthday. or Zach Moss at the Arizona Cardinals? I'm going to go, this is a really, really close one for me, and it's really tough, but I think I'm going to go with Zach Moss. He's shown that he's the goal line back for the Bills. I think that Cardinals-Bills game is a little bit more higher scoring, so a better chance that he gets into the end zone. And I hope Myers gets the same level of targets, but that Baltimore defense is much, much better than the Jets defense is.
Yeah, I want to learn your process for how you cook up these start sits, because I think they're very good week in and out. And I think there's another note here to, again, taking what we just talked about, putting it into practice. I'm going Zach Moss as well, and I think it's because specifically the over-under for the Bills-Cardinals game should be higher, and that just means more potential for scoring across the entire game, more potential for scoring for Zach Moss, as opposed to thinking, oh, well, the Bills are going to be throwing against the Cardinals, so Zach Moss isn't going to get any opportunity. No, I'm not doing that. I'm playing Zach Moss because of the game just as a whole. And the game environment, as our friend, well, maybe your friend, Peter Overzet likes to say.
So that's a good point you bring up. And I think the over-under can be used as a tiebreaker in some of these situations. But again, only really at the extremes. I mean, if you're deciding between two players that have a 55-point over-under and a 54-point over-under, I wouldn't automatically give it to the one with the 55. But if we look at this week, the Bills Cardinals matchup has an over under of 56 points. The over under for the Ravens Patriots is 43.5. So that's basically a 2-touchdown difference, and ostensibly 2 more touchdowns that players in the Bills Cardinals game, you know, might have an opportunity to score. So our next one is also hopefully a little tricky, but it's Leonard Fournette at the Carolina Panthers or Jonathan Taylor at the Tennessee Titans. I'm going to go with Leonard Fournette. He has shown that he is the clear pass catching back for the Bucs. I think the Panthers have enough offensive firepower to hopefully make the game competitive and maybe not make it like the Saints game on Sunday Night Football. And yeah, again, I'm going to need Jonathan Taylor getting 15 plus touches a game before I'm trusting him back in the lineup.
I'm jumping on the groupthink. I totally agree with that. And that's where my gut went. Just the fact that Leonard Fournette is seeing targets and is the pass catching back, that makes the decision for me. I need to see it, like you said, from Jonathan Taylor. And I don't know, that Colts offense just feels very weird. So let's move on.
Okay, our next one is a same game sort of flip-flop here. We've got Sterling Shepard versus the Eagles or Travis Fulgham at the New York Giants. Where do you lean here?
I just told you before this, I made a trade that involved receiving Travis Fulgham. Never had him on a team until now. But so I am rolling him out there in this matchup. I think Fulgham's been, you know, fairly consistent. DeSean Jackson is on the IR from what I read in the news, so I expect Fulgham to still be a primary target for Carson Wentz, and I like that a lot more than the, you know, the inconsistency of Daniel Jones on the other side throwing to Sterling Shepard.
Yep, give me Travis Fulgham as well. Okay, let's see if we can make this a clean sweep of agreements. Our last one here is Philip Lindsay at the Las Vegas Raiders or Mike Williams at the Miami Dolphins.
Okay, I'm going to go Mike Williams here. And I think I've put everything into practice to make sure that this process is correct. I may be biased because Herbert has just been balling out. Justin Herbert, quarterback for the LA Chargers and future of the franchise. And he connected with Mike Williams in this game. I know he's had some games where, you know, Mike Williams disappears, but he's been looked at in the end zone. He's been getting some production, and that's the game where I see more opportunity because Herbert just continues to throw, whereas I don't know how many touches Philip Lindsay is going to get, and you could see Drew Locke just start throwing all over instead of getting Lindsay involved on the ground. Like, Lindsay doesn't get any receptions really either, so the opportunity here is for Mike Williams. I think Mike Williams might be the better player too. Cross positional is tough for, in terms of talent, like we said, but I think Mike Williams is the better player.
I'm with you on Mike Williams as well. I mean, I think he's got the higher ceiling. I mean, maybe it would have been a better question if I had gone with Melvin Gordon against the Raiders. I mean, this is a scenario where, you know, I'm looking at one of my leagues now, and Melvin Gordon is projected for about 10.5 points, whereas Mike Williams is projected for 11.5 points. And if you think about it, I mean, Mike Williams certainly has a better chance of hitting his ceiling than Melvin Gordon or Philip Lindsay do. So hopefully, again, y'all learned something today, got a little help with your decision-making, but that's all we've got for now. For Andrew Mackins at Andrew Mackins, I am Sam Hoppin at Sam Hoppin. You can follow our podcast account at Pod After TD. And with that, the Nick Folk is good.